Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Day by day, the suffering continues to unfold in Haiti, a death toll that could hit 200,000. Hunger and thirst and dire medical need in the streets, the immediate humanitarian challenge is huge. And then comes rebuilding. Haiti had little before and less now, after food and water and medical attention. What is the road forward for this shattered country? This hour, On Point Relief for Haiti, Rebuilding Haiti. You can join the conversation. What are you hearing right now from friends, family, relief workers in Haiti? What's the road out of destruction to rebuilding? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a crowd gathered over the weekend at the gates of the collapsed National Palace in Port-au-Prince looking for clean drinking water. And many still looking for clean drinking water days later. Joining us right now from Northampton, Massachusetts, is Tracy Kidder. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author who chronicled the life of Dr. Paul Farmer and his work in aid in Haiti in his book Mountains Beyond Mountains. His latest book is Strength in What Remains, A Journey of Remembrance and Forgetting. Tracy Kidder, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be here.
It's nice to be here. It's tough to be there. The latest wires, Tracy, say we've just had six big U.S. helicopters land on the grounds of that damaged presidential palace. Uh-huh. A couple of thousand U.S. Marines approaching the shore, 1,000 or so U.S. troops already there. They're running the airport. Your thoughts over this last week as you've watched this country, which you know quite well, Tracy, dealing with this enormous catastrophe?
Well, you know, I think there's so much to say, I don't hardly know where to begin, but Haiti's extreme vulnerability to earthquakes, the natural disasters, I should say, has a long history, and our country hasn't always played a pretty part in that history. But you know, at the moment, what I'm sort of fixated on is this business of trying to save as many lives as possible, and then the recovery. I have some stuff, some fresh stuff from Partners in Health, which is the, in case your listeners don't know, you know, this is the very large private aid organization that has been working in Haiti, as well as in other countries, but in Haiti for 20 years, and has a huge operation there, 10 hospitals and clinics, which they run in very close coordination with the Ministry of Health.
Mm-hmm. This is Paul Farmer's group.
Right. They have about 4,000 employees in Haiti. Almost all of them are Haitian. Partners in Health, you know, endeavors to make everything indigenous, and to strengthen the public sector, to strengthen governmental organizations, so that you really build infrastructure and expertise, and this makes them, I think, rather unusual among aid organizations.
Tracy,
not the only organization that does this, but they're one of the important ones.
What are you hearing from people in aid positions about the speed of relief that has and has not come into Haiti in the last
week?
Well,
it's getting a little better. The thing about Partners in Health is that none of their facilities were damaged in the quake. But they are some distance from the capital. They have set up plenty of field hospitals. They've now reclaimed a part of the central hospital. They're hospitals that are that have operating facilities are just flooded out in the Central Plateau. They've just got a new operating room up and running in a place called Croix du Bouquet, which is about half an hour from Port-au-Prince. They're just about to begin operations there. At the Central Hospital, though, where they're operating, and all these places that are operating 24/7. The thing is, I mean, there are more than 1,000 patients right now waiting at the Central Hospital for surgeries.
And never mind all the others still lying in the streets. And what's your sense? We've seen the images now, right now, of patients just pouring out of the capital of Port-au-Prince by any means they can find, truck or foot or wagon, you name it. I mean, is there anything like a structure waiting for them in the countryside that can support people fleeing the city?
Of course not. But there is a tremendous medical operation out there, medical and public health operation, Partners in Health, but it is being swamped. The biggest problem they're having at the moment is getting surgical supplies to their different operating sites, the different surgical sites, which are, as I said, are going crazy. I mean, but they have been bringing airplanes in. They have caravans going, with the help of the UN, from the Dominican Republic. I just have these notes on three flights that have landed now, that one coming from Rutgers. These are all to help out with PIH, with a surgeon and a bunch of nurses and supplies on board, one from Dartmouth. And I guess there's some other planes. This is a little confusing.
Yeah, well, they're normally 30 or 35 flights a day coming into that airport, 100 coming in, 100 slots a day, and I'm reading here the U.S. military, Tracy, has a kind of a descending order of priorities. Number one, planes with water. Number two, planes with supplies and food. And number three, medical personnel and medicine. Dire need for all.
A dire need for all. I understand they have to make priorities. I wanted to, Tom, if we have a moment, one of the dispatches I got this morning from PIH people in Haiti had to do with this issue of violence. And what they're telling me is that there's not nearly the level of violence you might think there is if you watch too many TV shows. So my suspicion is about some correspondents, certainly not all, is that they like to exaggerate or, play up the violence around them because it makes them seem like they're incredibly brave. But this is no excuse. I'm being told this morning by PIH people who are there on the ground and traveling all over Port-au-Prince at all hours without any problems at all. The city is very calm, and that this supposed threat of violence should absolutely not be used as an excuse not to get the aid that's needed in there.
I guess important not to exaggerate it, also not to ignore what has been there. There has been looting of some of the commercial area of town. It's not as though there's been none.
Well, of course not. Mm-hmm. I mean, but what would have happened? Just imagine Boston under these circumstances.
Any American city. New Orleans, New York.
I mean, one of the things this reminds me of is 1994 when we sent in these 20,000 U.S. troops. What I fear is, those troops, because their commanders decided that one of their biggest priorities would be to make sure those troops were kept safe, Well, if PIH doctors and nurses and community health workers can travel freely around Port-au-Prince without any threat of danger, it seems to me that most people don't have too much to worry about. And here was a quote from the correspondent from Haiti this morning. I thought your readers, listeners would like to hear this. While security must be a concern wherever and whenever people are desperate to provide for themselves and their families, the most effective response is not military intervention, but massive, well-organized, and equitable humanitarian assistance. I think we know that. And I'm not saying, I'm not knocking the military. God knows, I think that all people who are earnestly trying to help here, I'm grateful to.
Absolutely. Tracy Kidder is with us, author of Mountains Beyond Mountains. And Tracy, stand by. We've got a lot of listeners with insights and questions from Tampa Bay, Florida. Amy's calling. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question about just how meaningful our contributions are to this crisis. There's a great article in the New York Times today that explains how our ambassador to Haiti is telling Haitian people not to come to the United States because they will be refused entry, and even critically injured people are being denied temporary visas to go to hospitals in Miami. So I was hoping that your commentator could speak to that issue.
And let me just clarify on that. I'm looking at that very report, Amy, and it's actually Haiti's ambassador in Washington. And Tracy, perhaps you read this, but it's a U.S. Air Force cargo plane equipped with radio transmitters flying for hours over Haiti every day, broadcasting news and a recorded message from Haiti's ambassador, Raymond Joseph, in Creole, saying, don't rush onto boats to leave the country. If you do that, we'll have even worse problems. And, if you reach the U.S., if you think all the doors will be wide open to you, that's not at all the case. They will intercept you right in the water, send you back home. Is the U.S. doing what it should, Tracy?
Tom, I don't feel confident to answer that question. I'm really not. I've sort of been focused on in another direction. I don't think that we should be closing our doors the Haitians. I do understand that, you know, at the moment and for the next few weeks to come, probably one wants to try to restore as much order as possible. And having people take off on dangerous boats is not probably going to help. But to get people who badly need surgery to the places where they can get it, I mean, I think that it would be unconscionable to deny that. I must say, though, that it is logistically very difficult right now to get patients to hospitals in the United States. Partners in Health has sent 4 patients, all of whose lives were saved, to Philadelphia, where they got free care. But this is not going to be the solution to the problem. It's just too difficult logistically. What has to happen, I think, is to get what Haiti needs into Haiti as quickly as possible, and more quickly than is being done now. But if you've been to Haiti, you know that the infrastructure there is dreadful. And so, you know, I have to assume that most of the people working there are doing the very best they can, trying to save as many lives as possible. But U.S. immigration policy strikes me as incredibly benighted, but it's been that way for an awfully long time. The famous fact that any Cuban reaching the shore, our shores, you know, gets to stay, and any Haitian gets sent home.
It's a complicated picture because you also see Haitians saying, you know, the brain drain that has taken immigrants to the United States for so many years also hurts Haiti, Tracy.
It does hurt Haiti. Of course it does. And the same thing is true in Africa. But the one of the things that, if I can brag on Partners in Health again, one of the things that they insist on doing is making, as I said, they're making their projects indigenous. Of those 120 doctors that Partners in Health employs in Haiti, all but I think one or two are Haitian.
We're going to dig right on in here. Tracy Kidder, author of Mountains Beyond Mountains, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Gunshots there from Haitian police trying to chase away looters in Port-au-Prince. Much more widely, Haitians looking for food and water, somewhere to sleep in the country's collapsed capital and the cities and countryside surrounding. We're talking today about rebuilding Haiti, immediate needs, and the road ahead. Here's U.S. Ambassador to Haiti, Kenneth Merton, speaking with NBC's Today Show yesterday about security in the capital.
The Haitian police, due to their own significant losses, are degraded. You have a UN force which has had its own losses, so they're not able to perform at the level they probably would like. However, given that, I think things are going reasonably well.
Reasonably well in the midst of calamity. Yesterday at a hospital in Port-au-Prince, UN Special Envoy to Haiti, former U.S. President Bill Clinton, spoke about the aid that was arriving.
We need very specific things that there's a shortage of. That's what I tried to do today. We called this hospital. It's the biggest place. And we said, tell us very specifically everything you need, and that's what we brought down so they could operate and take care of these kids and the other people.
We're joined right now from Miami by Marlene Bastien. She's founder and executive director of Haitian Women of Miami, co-founder of the Haitian American Grassroots Coalition. She also happens to be a candidate for U.S. Congress in Miami's Miami-based 17th District in Florida, Democratic candidate. Marlene Bastien, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Larry Burns, director of the Washington-based think tank, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Larry Burns, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
Marlene, first to you, what's the latest you're hearing from friends, relatives in Haiti?
That the catastrophe is so much bigger than we thought. At the beginning, we were concentrating our efforts in Port-au-Prince, but family members was still under the rubble in Jacmel, which from recent accounts is quasi-destroyed. People are still texting their family members here, saying that they need help in Jacmel. They have not been touched by the relief efforts. Families and friends in Léogane, L-E-O-G-A-N-E, also texting, sending SOS messages from Petit Guave, from Grand Guave, from Lekai, the south of Haiti. Every radio station this weekend in Miami was flooded by thousands of phone calls from family members in Haiti, many of them texting from under the rubble of their homes, their office buildings, their schools, asking for help, sending SOS for help. And we have all family members here who've been waiting patiently to find a way to get through Haiti, waiting from the federal government to tell them how they can get to provide resources to their loved one. And then I can tell you, based on the calls that I've listened to this weekend, there is a growing impatience, and I fear that family members who've been getting these SOS messages will, and they've already started, by the way, Tom, going through the Dominican Republic. And there again, there are concerns because, as you know, there's been a lot of frictions between Haitians and Dominicans in the Dominican Republic, and a lot of violence. So the situation is really getting tense here in Miami.
Marlene Bastien, please stand by in Miami. Larry Burns in Washington. The immediate needs are enormous and very clearly very far from being met at this point, but there's a lot headed toward Haiti, and already the president there, Preval, is talking about the long term, the road back. He said in the last couple of days, we cannot just cure the wounds of the earthquake. We must develop the economy, agriculture, education, health, and reinforce democratic institutions. It sounds like an overwhelming agenda in the midst of crisis, but the beginnings of whatever will follow will be laid out within this relief effort, Larry Burns.
Yes, of course, there are a lot of problems on all sides. One of the problems is that historically, at least in the past several decades, Haiti's problems were never Haiti's alone to solve. And in fact, Haiti was on the agenda very much so, ironically enough, on both of these presidents who are now special envoys to the UN on Haitian affairs, that is President Clinton and President Bush. The fact is that on the U.S. agenda, for years, Haiti's function was not to bother U.S. policymakers. That is why, for so many years, the United States supported military dictatorships, including Papa and Baby Doc, because they promised kind of the tranquility of the grave to U.S. policymakers. That is, Washington didn't want boat people taking the treacherous journey from Haiti to Miami. It didn't want illegal migrants going into other countries trying to get into the United States. It didn't want a confrontation between the poor and Haiti's tiny but all-powerful elite. And most of all, Washington didn't want Jean-Bertrand Aristide as Haiti's president. And so rather than view Aristide as sort of a national treasurer, because he had been elected under constitutional means, he was, an odd duck and with many shortcomings, but he still was a person who had the confidence and backing of most Haitians. So what both the Clinton and the Bush administration did was to marginalize him and eventually arrange for his being exiled from the country. So the country didn't have a natural political growth, nor did it have a natural economic growth, because what Washington wanted here was the very high tariff on U.S. rice coming into Haiti. Haiti is a rice-eating nation. The United States wanted to eliminate that. And so economically speaking, Haiti doesn't really have an economy, nor does it have prospects to have an economy, unless the people, the donors, before they start suffering donor fatigue, they get together and plot out a viable economy for Haiti, which means sacrifices on their part.
Marlene Bastien, how do you rebuild a country without an economy, if you agree with that characterization?
I believe that there are a lot of resources inside the country that we've neglected over the years to the point that now Haiti gets everything that it consumes, including rice. We used to be producers of most of the rice that we ate, and now most of the rice come from the U.S. We used to be the first exporters of coffee. During the 17th century, we provided most of the coffee that was used in France. We were the pearl of the Antilles. And then over the years, we, with the Tontamac codes and then the heavy destruction of Haiti's agriculture, we've become an economy dependent mainly from the outside. And I think it is time now to really use the resources within, starting with the agriculture, because we are blessed. We've been blessed with fertile land in Haiti. And then we've, as a result of the destructions of the local markets, even peasants who've spent their life cultivating their lands, they were forced to find their ways to Port-au-Prince and then to the Dominican Republic, to Cuba. And at a time, we even were encouraging them to leave, to go to Cuba, to the Dominican Republic. So I believe that it is time now that we have a plan. We must have a plan, because the events of the last 5 days shows that Haiti was very ill prepared. It was ill prepared before, and in the implementation of this crisis, we see that nothing, no infrastructure, was in place. So we need to start by having a master plan, a strategic plan, where all voices in the country are represented, and that we have their input to develop the agriculture. Build roads, allow the peasants to really bring back the agriculture where they need the support, they need the technical support to do it. And then I think we've underestimated the resources that we have within the nation. And I think if we want to start this right, we need to start with the resources that are there.
Marlene and Bastien, please stand by in Miami. We're looking at immediate needs and the road ahead in Haiti. And by the way, we continue to have lots of information on how you can contribute to Haiti's very dire release needs right now, relief needs, at our website, onpointradio.org. But we're looking at those needs, those immediate needs, and the road ahead. Let me get a call from Malden, Massachusetts. Carmelez, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you know?
Tom, I'm Haitian. First, I want to thank the media, especially. I don't want to single out any, you know, specific media, CNN, Anderson Cooper, Larry King. They've been doing a tremendous work for us. They keep us really informed. But right now, Tom, it's a wipeout. The main concern that I have, that, you know, I already talked to some friends on Twitter and a lot of, you know, blog. My main concern right now is how those money, because there's going to be a lot of money, how are we going to block the Haitian government? Because the corruption is so high over there. My main goal is to fight for the Haitian government, not have a dime in all this money that's going to pour in, okay? Because basically, when you look at it, Haiti, I understand it's a natural disaster. But when you look at the Haitian government, they're really not prepared. I mean, when you look at the whole situation, you're like, where's your government? Even the president, he never, you know, come out to give a statement and say, well, you know, here's what we're going to do. Here's the plan. People have been out there for 6-7 days, and they never heard from their president. You tell me this is a government that functions, and I think that Bush been saying it, or Clinton, that they're going to use the, your money going to spend wisely. And I really need more details about it, because my main concern, there's going to be enough money to rebuild Haiti, is how they, you know, after the crew, the camera crew, when they, you know, leave the country, are we going to give all this money to the Haitian government? But I think people need to really, really pay attention about it, because my main concern is about corruption.
Carmelez, we hear it very loud and clear, and I thank you for your call. Marlene Bastien, how about it? After the camera crews are gone, you hear the concern. They're from Carmelez. What about corruption? I mean, we've seen the images of how complete the devastation is. If you also have very little government infrastructure, how do you begin to stand up again?
Haiti has a unique opportunity to really get Haiti out of this horrible situation that has been building over 200 years. But I agree with him that the Haitian government, the state, which includes the Haitian government, needs to have a plan. It needs to address the corruption that is really a big concern for all of us. It needs to have a plan, and the plan needs to include all voices. But also, we also need to tap into the wealth of resources that we have in the diaspora. We have so many Haitian professionals representing all disciplines, willing and ready to go and help Haiti. There's been some resistance in the country, but I hope that the state of Haiti realizes right now that it cannot do this alone. It needs to tap into the resources outside, especially when we know that we've lost so many important resources, people who've worked there, who contributed, such as Jean Anglade, for example, the former Minister of Public Health, Public Works, rather, under President Aristide, who died. We're talking about people like Gina Porcena, Anne-Marie Coriolan, people working in different disciplines. So we need the state of Haiti. The government needs to tap into the resources. It must find a way to really take advantage of all these talents that are waiting to be put to use in Haiti. And it definitely must address the issue of corruption.
But the death toll large at home, and corruption, as our caller says, a big issue there. Larry Burns, you hear our Haitian caller saying he wants to see not a dime go to the Haitian government. Now, how do you rebuild a country if you have that little faith in the government itself?
Well, I've been very disappointed in the performance of President Préval. I think he was a very close associate of President Aristide. He was a very honorable man, and I thought that he would be a transformative factor in Haiti's public life. It hasn't really turned out that way. One of the most controversial things he's done is to continue the political disruption in Haiti by banning Aristide's political party from contesting the upcoming election, which I think it was a very negative act on his part. Haiti's problems are both internal and, of course, external. Externally, one of the problems is that you have these donor conferences, and while the spotlight is on, you get these very large pledges coming from the EU, coming from Japan and the United States and so forth. And then you start having the evaporative process begins to function. That is, the money that ends up that was committed to Haiti sometimes turns out to be no more than 10% of the original fund. So Haiti has never been able to rationally plan. And of course, the other aspect is that those nations most concerned about Haiti's role, that is the United States and France, have sort of other fish to fry. It's not just that they're concerned about Haiti taken as an isolated factor, but they want Haiti to be a certain kind of country. So rather than serving Haiti's national interests, they are assiduous in serving their own national interests, and this has done very significant damage to the Haitian political fiber.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about rebuilding Haiti, immediate needs, and the road ahead. Marlene Bastien joins us from Miami. She's founder and executive director of Haitian Women of Miami, co-founder of the Haitian American Grassroots Coalition. Larry Burns is here, director of the think tank, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington. Michael in Nashville, Tennessee. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I listened to y'all talk a little bit about, what a country with no real economy can do to rebuild itself. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking of two people that I would really expect to step up and try to fill in the gaps where they need to. The first is the most obvious, the Catholic Church. That country is 80% Catholic. But the second is the media. It's the media themselves that have just as much reach and influence as any charity organization. just being that you're the mouthpiece, you know, you're the arm of the people, and you can be the good arm of the people by fostering, you know, positive cultural experiences through story. One of my biggest complaints is the reporting on violence and looting and stuff like that. People in Haiti, you know, one thing that does get around is the airwaves. And if they're hearing that their neighbors are stealing and killing and doing stuff of that nature, if that's the report that they're getting back, they're going to arm themselves with sticks or with whatever it is that they have available, whatever they can pick up and find in the rubble.
Michael, point taken. May I ask you, Michael, though, on the, you know as well as I do that on the other side of this very traumatic period, those cameras and the big the big satellite shells will move on, and they will not stay there reporting day after day from Haiti as the hard work of rebuilding begins. What about then?
Then there is no real what about them if you're collaborating. If you leave them and abandon them and abandon the story that promotes peace, then, yeah, there is a big what about them. But if you assist and enable them to foster their national identity through charity and through cultural commitment, then the what about them turns into a great positive story and not a negative story. But the fact is, at the end of the day, there's a million media organizations, and they're going to try to capture the story that they want that promotes, you know, their readers' attention, rather than helping, collaborating, and being a part of, you know, that journey towards the oneness that they need to experience. They need to experience. It's a psychological effect.
Michael, we hear it, and we thank you for your call. Marlene, what about the U.S. television coverage, let's say radio for that matter? But I can't help but be struck on the evening news. We have many stories now, personal interest stories of individual Haitians, you know, a young mother having a baby in a park, the network news, medical correspondent, maybe even helping with some of these medical situations. Are we getting the big picture story on Haiti, or are we getting too many moving but too personal stories of interest?
I believe that the story about violence has been overblown, like most people here. The story of Haitians digging for bodies with their bare hands, if it weren't for them, so many people more would have perished, and there are still thousands who will die because of the slowness of the relief. I think the story that needs to be told more is the story of those Haitians who are working with their bare hands, basically little children crawling, adults crawling in crevices and to pull people out that they don't even know. Demystifying this saying that from Guinea, black hate black. We've seen stories since Tuesday of people doing their best for complete strangers. I believe that this is the story that needs to be told, because so far the effort has not reached most of the people who are impacted.
Yeah, no, we see
that's,
it.
That's the sadness of the whole thing.
We see it and we know it. U.S. Marines waiting to come in with bulldozers. Still a lot of food and water and medical attention needed, and we can only hope and push for that to get in there faster. But as all that happens, the outline of what lies on the other side emerges as well. Robin in Schenectady, New York. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that the only thing that matters right now is to get heavy equipment in there. I think as long as there are still people alive, and there may be, or slowly dying, we need to be flying or bringing in by boat. We have both options available. Our military always moves heavy equipment. They move jeeps and airplanes.
Yep.
And that is the number one priority right now, is to get heavy equipment there. And they can do it they've been saying they can't land planes. Well, fine. It's not that far away. We have aircraft carriers. We can put all kinds of heavy equipment in those boats and send it to Haiti to get people out of the rubble, because, you know, nothing is more horrific than imagining laying in rubble and people talking about rebuilding. I know it has to be done, but there are still people in there.
Yeah,
I'm not worried about the violence is inevitable. People, it's not stealing to make profit. They're dying and they need food and they need things.
And Marlene telling us Haitian Americans in this country getting text messages from people stuck under that rubble. Sadly, we're coming up on the time, the relief leaders are saying, when rescue will not be a viable option for many of them anymore. This just keeps churning forward. And Robin, thanks for your call. John in Des Moines, Iowa. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My thought on the matter is that it's going to take commitment from a lot of different sources. I would start with universities all across the world bringing in technology, and I might say some building codes for that country so that these buildings don't pancake like they have. I would say green is the future. Okay, I think the major solar manufacturers, wind generators, and battery manufacturers should look at this as a place to showcase new world technology. And I think that would produce jobs. If the universities get behind it, that would produce education in that country. And I think they eventually could work it all out. I'm not an expert on this, but I certainly see Port-au-Prince as way too big. When you have shanty towns built on the side of mountains with no building codes, if the status quo prevails, then Haiti's just going to go back to what it has been.
John, thanks for your call. Larry Burns, how about it? We know the history. I mean, France occupied Haiti for more than 100 years until they got kicked out in 1804. U.S. Marines in there for, nearly 20 years, 1915 to 1934. Woodrow Wilson sent them in. It's not as though foreigners haven't had a big impact in the past. What about John's vision? Can you imagine it? Is somehow a structure of organization and resources that could make Haiti a green model on the other side of this?
Well, sounds pretty good, but I think if we just look at what happened in the past several weeks, it may muffle our enthusiasm. This has been a very high-risk political operation by President Obama. I mean, clearly, the risk is that people will start thinking of Katrina because there has been excessive delay, and one doesn't know why there's been delay, but there has been delay, and every second that passes, more people have died. Now, it's rather interesting that the administration anticipated months ago that there may be serious relief efforts that will be launched in the Latin American region. That was one of the reasons why the United States reconstituted the Fourth Fleet, which had been demobilized in 1950, and then several months ago was reconstituted. And one of the purposes of this fleet was to project U.S. authority throughout Latin America and to speed a humanitarian and natural disaster relief to affected regions. And since then, in the past several years, the United States has conducted, the Navy has conducted, over 100 medical exercises affecting hundreds of thousands of people that is practicing about what to do in an emergency.
You would think that would mean swift relief now.
Exactly. And what does one see? One listens to this gobbledygook. I think it was a terrible mistake to entrust this functioning, the aid functioning, to the USAID, which does not have a reputation for bringing fast and comprehensive solutions to problems, but has been always considered a heavily bureaucratized operation. So, you know, there's a lot to say, but what's going to happen will be that at a certain point, you're quite right, the cameras are going to leave, and the national or international focus on Haiti will dissipate, and people will continue to try to get into this country illegally, and hundreds and thousands of them will die trying to do so, because to revitalize the Haitian society suggests that there's a international will and as well as a national will to do this, and I think that's yet to be proven.
Let's go to Stephanie in Boston. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I so appreciate that. I just wanted to let you know that, of course, we know that remittances are a big source of money to the Haitian people. From
cash
home.
From abroad sent from sent home, yeah.
Yeah, and my husband's family live here, and also they have many relatives in Laogan, Carrefour, and also Port-au-Prince, who have thankfully all made it alive through this. And the problem is in Laogan is that they are not getting any attention there and have no food and water. And so this is the scary part, to have them alive and still not know whether or not they will be okay.
It absolutely, and as we said from the very top, the need right now is dire, and it's food and water and medical attention. First, we're glad they're alive, and we hope that relief is on their way to them, Stephanie. I appreciate your call. Let's get another right here. Patrick in Somerville, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Very critical issue. I think one of the issues in terms of reconstruction, we need to, as sort of Haitian people, as well as international communities, thinking of federalizing Haiti. Because one of the mistakes that the U.S. made in 1915 during the occupation was to really center and centralize Port-au-Prince, become sort of this administrative place. So Port-au-Prince has to be decentralized, and having different investors going into different parts of Haiti so that the large populations, the large scales of slums are no longer based in Port-au-Prince. And you have also, in terms of future coup d'etats, which we have had, if we have the kind of structure that we have in the U.S. states, for example, governors and senators are taking care of each state, so the provinces in Haiti would become relatively autonomous, and Haiti would become sort of a better country.
Decentralized. But, Patrick, let me ask you, who would lead a process of decentralization? The government's not likely to want to give up that central power.
Well, you know what? At this point, because the government is on its knees, we would have to enter into a serious partnership with the United States, with the European Union and the UN to really advocate for this kind of policy. Otherwise, we are going to go back to a failed state, which we have had, and not really having proper democracy.
Yeah, but let me get another call. Patrick, thank you very much. John in Richmond, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello to your panel.
Hi.
A similar theme. Most of Haiti's history has been imposed solutions, imposed political solutions, post-colonial, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Calling from the land of the town meeting, when we have been going in there, the army, the aid agencies, they're finding natural leaders, people with expertise in, Haitians with expertise in food distribution, in health care, in these people exist now. What can we do, since the system appears to be completely broken, help them reformulate their own system based on the people who are doing the job now, rather than imposing an international solution, and then create a group to support of donors that would support an indigenous solution?
It's a good, great question, Marlene Bastien. What about it? How can the outside world help Haiti reformulate without recolonizing?
I think that's the way to go, and that's why I say that at the beginning of the show that we need a plan de société, and then the resources and the talents in Haiti need to be put to use.
But who puts that together? Is it the United Nations? Is it the Haitian government, which people say is in such disarray?
I believe the state, and I'm not when I talk about the state, I mean the Haitian government. I need the civil society. I mean the professionals, the different organizations that have been working very hard and have done a wonderful job, given that we've lost many of our talents. But
yeah,
there are many still living in the country. They have not been given a chance. It is time to put them to work. Right now, our people are in need, and we have talents in Haiti waiting to partake in the rebuilding process, in the relief effort, and then we have talents outside of the country. I think it is time that we put these talents to use. It is time for the federal government to lift the ban and allow these professional groups that are waiting with their suitcases packed to get to the island, work in collaboration with organizations on the terrain to provide the relief. The time, we cannot wait anymore. The ban needs to be lifted. If it's not lifted, what's happening? And
is there a ban on expatriates coming back to Haiti?
Well, we were told when we met with the vice president on Saturday that we cannot go. We have to wait. We have to wait for the federal government. So we need this ban lifted. My organization, from the Haitian Women of Miami, we've received tons. I mean, 9 o'clock we started receiving calls. People came this weekend, Saturday, Sunday. When can I go? Mm. We need to help. We are ready to help. These are nurses, doctors, scientists, technicians, all kind of from all disciplines. They are ready to go. And then we need to be very careful. If we do not want Haiti to get back to the same situation again, we need to be sure to train those on the terrain so that after they leave, after the cameras leave, those resources stay in the country to train others so that Haiti can once for all get out of the conditions that it's been in.
It's a big vision starting from a very, very tough place right now. I say again, there are instructions to get to all kinds of relief agencies at our website, onpointradio.org. The real is immediate, and it is dire, and it is right now. The way ahead, a tough one, and we will continue to follow it. Marlene Bastien, co-founder of the Haitian American Grassroots Coalition, thanks for joining us today from Miami.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And Larry Burns at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.